funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
For the duration of human history, we have struggled with this question. Do we control our own destiny? We want to believe we can, but there are teachings handed down from the ancient world that say God or gods play a role in our lives. If we place our faith in modern science, we can't escape the knowledge that our genes hold the keys to significant aspects of our lives, whether or not we can predict their effects. But we also have this glimmer of hope. What if we learn to control the genes that make our brains and our bodies and our lives what they are? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and staff cancer physician at Columbia University Medical Center. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. He thinks of his new book, A Careful Account of Our Dawning Understanding of the Power of Genetics, as a kind of prequel to his monumental work on cancer. This latest book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha, welcome back to Think.
Oh, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
What is the simplest sentence you can give us that explains what a gene is?
A gene is a unit of information that moves from parents to offspring to transmit biological information from one to the other.
Beautifully done. do genes act?
That's about 100 years condensed into one sentence.
And we'll unpack that 100 years over this next hour. Do genes act all at once at the birth of a cell, or do they continue to provide instructions on an ongoing basis?
They continue to provide instructions on an ongoing basis. In fact, some genes won't act in the body until much later. I mean, again, if you imagine, just to give you a simple example, you know, when in an embryo, before there's any blood cell, the genes that make blood cells work, won't even be on. They'll be in the genome, but they won't be active. You can imagine them like a symphony where maybe the violin isn't playing at the first minute, but only begins to play at the 20th minute. And this is the case for multiple genes across the human genome.
Do we understand, who or what the conductor is that gives that signal?
Well, the genome itself is the conductor. So the genes make proteins. That's one of the things that the genes make. Genes make messages called RNA, and that RNA ultimately makes proteins. And these proteins essentially conduct the genome. Hmm. So you can imagine that that within the genome is not just the score or the master score, but also the instructions about how to conduct that master score over time and space. In a very famous analogy, when this was discovered, they said the genome is not a passive blueprint. It's an active blueprint. The blueprint can get activated and silenced, and parts of it can be activated and silenced in time so that you can get, the complexity of real organisms like a human being.
What kinds of assumptions did ancient people make about the mechanisms that, say, caused children to resemble their parents?
The ancient idea, there were many, but I'll give you some highlights, and they're fascinating. The ancient ideas about, the question of why we resemble our parents is an ancient question, and also the question why we don't resemble our parents. And one of the ancient ideas was that that parents essentially transmitted their characteristics, their features, like little messages, into their sperm and eggs, even before sperm and eggs were known as cells, essentially transmitted these messages, and they somehow got combined or melded or blended together in the embryo, and thereby gave rise to the embryo. It's a little bit like saying if you had a blue parent and a yellow parent, you'd be born with the green child.
Hmm. The craziest concept.
Another theory.
Oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Sorry, just another theory. This was kind of a modification of another theory. It's a fascinating theory, and there's a lovely picture in my book about this theory. And that's the idea that sperm or egg, depending on which side you believed, already contained a tiny miniature human being wrapped inside it, sort of like a little embryonic fetus. It was called a homunculus, and the idea was that the human beings were just sort of, we just added water and we sort of blew up in time and space and became our full selves. And in fact, of course, if you thought that through, it would have to mean that even that homunculus would have to have its own homunculus inside it. And that homunculus would have its own, like a Russian doll stretching into the future. In other words, we would have all our future descendants sort of wrapped in progressively smaller and smaller dolls inside our bodies.
Like a mirror within a mirror.
Like a mirror within a mirror, or a doll within a doll, or a human within a human.
I love the word homunculus, by the way.
Yes, exactly.
Most people recall learning about this obsessive Austrian monk, Gregor Mendel, in high school biology. What was so revolutionary about the work he did with pea plants?
It's good that we asked the question about what the ancients thought about heredity, because, as I said, for the longest time, people thought that, you know, messages just blended together and gave rise to who you were. And Gregor Mendel began work with pea plants and began to ask the question, what are these messages? What do they look like? What do they seem like? And he made the startling discovery that, in fact, rather than blending together, when he isolated a single such feature in a pea flower or in a pea plant, rather than blending together, in fact, they never blended. They sort of remained discrete. They were little particles of information, or discrete little particle is the best word to describe it, particles of information that were moving from parents to children. And they remained like particles. They were never broken up or diluted or, altered in any way across these generations. They remained particular, much like atoms remain particular and they can't be broken into pieces. And so that's what Mendel discovered. He didn't coin the word gene. That's often a misconception, that Mendel coined the word genes. He discovered all of this based purely on experiments and mathematical reasoning. And it was only decades later that scientists would ascribe the word gene to describe that particle of information that's moving from one parent to the other. So it's a revolutionary idea because it completely changes the way we think about heredity. We used to think about heredity as, you know, we transmit messages to our children, and these messages get blended together in some kind of wearing blender of heredity. But Mendel said, wait, that's not the case at all. What we're really transmitting is minute bits. I'm using the word bits in a kind of a information or computer sense. Minute bits of information that are not broken up. They're indelible, and they're not diluted or broken up, and they just combine in different ways. And it's the fact that they combine in, you know, these different ways that is responsible for the astonishing diversity and the continuity that we see in living organisms. The continuity is an illusion. At the bottom of it are sort of pixels of information.
Mendel was not heralded in his own lifetime as a great scientist or as a great priest, for that matter.
One of the things about Mendel is that he essentially wrote one major paper. Of course, I mean, my God, what a paper. But he wrote that one major paper, and he had published a little bit. He's a natural historian. He published a little bit outside that. But aside from that one major paper, he's basically forgotten.
And Darwin never read that paper.
We have no evidence that Darwin read the paper. Darwin read widely about heredity. He read widely about interbreeding and intercrossing. And there's some evidence, not great evidence, there's some evidence that, in fact, a reference to Mendel's study, Mendel's original paper, was in somewhere buried inside Darwin's notes. But, of course, Darwin never read the paper. And Darwin actually never even, was never even someone who understood this this idea of genes as we understand it in a contemporary way.
Meanwhile, on through the end of the 19th century, people weren't absolutely sure what kinds of things could be passed down to subsequent generations. There was one horrible experiment involving mice who had their tails surgically removed.
A horrible experiment, but actually a very important experiment because it suddenly told us something. So I'll just repeat the experiment. It was August Weismann's experiment. And he essentially asked the question, going back to the way we set this up initially, if it's true that we are transmitting messages to our children through our bodies, then if we remove the tail of a mouse, then the child of that mouse should be born without a tail, because there's no message that could go from the tail instructing the child to form the baby mouse to form a tail. So he did this not just for one generation of mice, but for multiple generations. There's a rumor that he basically excised 902 mice tails. And to his surprise, and obviously very clarifying experiment, but to his surprise, he found that even the tail of the last mouse after multiple generations wasn't even shortened by 1 centimeter. It was exactly the same. So in other words, yet once again, the instructions to carry forward, to make a tail, as it were indelibly located within the mouse's genome. There was no, you couldn't erase it by removing the actual animal's tail.
You know, Siddhartha, what I found so interesting about these kind of parallel experiments is that while scientists are trying to understand the mechanisms of heredity, there had been people for a very long time deliberately breeding dogs and cats and workhorses and plants. They understood that there were ways that you could get the combination of qualities you wanted. They just didn't understand how it happened.
And that's what's amazing about Mendel in retrospect. The amazing thing about Mendel in retrospect is that, you know, people had been breeding cows and horses and roosters and chickens for generations. And they had noticed that you can actually select certain things, make certain, you know, you can make cows' horns bigger and dogs' temperaments different and so forth. So that had clearly been noticed. But what's interesting about it, no one had picked up the idea that behind this epic variance of organisms, you know, that seems so varied and sort of so continuous. You know, you have cows ranging from one height all the way to another height. You have human beings that range from one kind of nose all the way to a completely different kind of nose. That behind this epic variance were individual particles of information. And sometimes I liken this to saying, you know, if you look from very far away, you can look at a picture and it could seem as if it's drawn continuously, you know, with paint and paintbrushes and so forth. But if you zoom in very closely, all of a sudden you could realize in that particular picture is actually pixelated. They're little pixels of information, dots that could be either blue or red or green. And in fact, what seems like a continuous picture is actually comprised of little dots that are blue or red or green. And that's what Mendel figured out, that in fact behind heredity were pixels of information that were passed undiluted between parents and offspring.
What does an examination of the human genome tell us about the construct of race?
So fascinating things, again, covered in the second half of the book. You know, first half of the book, we'll talk about all these stories and all this history. But the second half of the book takes us into what does this mean today? So the human genome actually tells us a lot about race. And I will tell you some highlights. It's richly covered, so I'll just give you some highlights. Well, one thing it tells us is that we're a relatively young species. Or a relatively young group of interbreeding animals. We arose maybe 200 to 300,000 years ago and then diverged away from or moved away geographically from that point of origin, probably in Africa. We don't know the exact location. And here's the most important, or some of the most important highlights of that geographic divergence. And that is that, you know, the so-called races, you know, we use that word so loosely, even in this election season, we've been using that word so loosely. But this, the idea of so-called races, in fact, if you look at the genetics, the diversity in genetics between races, that is interracial diversity, is often more than intra-racial diversity. That means the diversity across races. And so the whole construct of races that, you know, that they're somehow clustering together genetic ideas or genetic traits, that's false to begin with. Just to give you a very concrete or finite example, if you compare an African man, I'm using the word African again to denote the so-called races, from Namibia to an African man from Egypt, they're as different from each other than, for instance, one man from Egypt and a man from Yemen. So the old idea about races needs to be reconsidered in the light of the genome. We'll talk a little bit more after the break.
Thank you for setting us up. My guest is Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Gene, An Intimate History. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Columbia University and Staff Cancer Physician at Columbia University Medical Center. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his first book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. We're talking today about his new book, The Gene, An Intimate History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. So before the break, you were saying that, if I understand this correctly, the differences among people who are believed to be the same race are often greater than the differences between people who are of different races.
That's correct. So again, to summarize, interracial diversity seems to dominate intra-racial diversity. Exactly what you said, the difference within the so-called Africans, the differences are greater than, could be greater than between, you know, just two other hypothetical human beings that across two races. Well, then you could say, wait a second, but what about, don't we know that certain genes or certain diseases cluster on certain, around certain geographic regions? What about that? What about that counterfactual? Just to give you another example, you know, isn't it true that sickle cell disease and that gene is more predominant in Afro-Caribbeans and people from the Indian subcontinent versus people of the so-called Caucasian or white race, and that's true too. It is true that if you look at particular genes, if you look at one gene in particular in question, you will find that it might cluster within a certain geographic variance and a certain geographic location, and therefore will cluster around one race. But of course, the point of race is not to look at one gene. It's to look at across the genome at multiple genes. And when you look at multiple genes, in fact, the diversity within so-called races is greater than the diversity across races.
Okay, I know I'm bopping around in time here, and I appreciate your patience with me, but I get very excited about this stuff. How was the term gene coined in 1909 before we really understood what exactly they were, what they looked like, how they worked?
The term was coined as a kind of biological necessity. Willem Johansson, the biologist, began to look at he began to look at all the new discoveries, including Mendel's discoveries that were made and subsequently revived, and said, we have to have a term for this thing, whatever it is. And it's a funny thing in science. Sometimes you need a term for something even before you know what that something is at a kind of deeper level. You know, just to give you another example, remember the atom. The word atom was coined long before we exactly knew what the atom was, how it looked, you know. And similarly, the word gene was coined long before we knew there was, you know, that it was genes were carried in DNA for the most part, or that they functioned by making proteins and RNA. But all of that stuff was not known. But there's a beautiful quote from Johansson who says, "It's a very useful little construct." Of course, it was not little at all. We're talking about it all the time today. But he said it's a very useful little construct to describe, obviously, what would later become much more concrete, but back then was totally abstract. The idea that there was this pixel of information moving from your parents to your offspring. He thought that we really needed a term, much like, you know, a century ago, almost exactly a century before, someone had said we need a term to describe a unit of matter, and that would be the atom.
So as people began to look for the mechanism by which parents could pass on particular qualities or flaws to subsequent generations, some people started thinking we needed to look at creating a stronger human race by declaring who was fit to reproduce given their characteristics. Tell us about the eugenics movement.
This is a fascinating and very troubling part of this history, too. And I actually, you know, in the gene, I crisscross these two stories. I crisscross the story, and this becomes a story about how, while we're exploring, while scientists are exploring and trying to find out how genes work and what they are, there's a parallel strand in society and culture that says, well, let's try to use genetic information that you don't even know what the gene is, but let's try to use the fact that humans pass on hereditary characteristics to improve the human race, to emancipate the human race. What's astonishing about this story, and I find it still astonishing, even having written and thought about it so much in this book, is that when it first was brought into existence, you know, by Francis Galton, that was Darwin's cousin, he thought it was going to be a great idea, and lots of progressive, not all progressive, but lots of people with progressive ideas about how human beings should be helped, how the weak should be helped, how the human race should be helped. I'm using words from that time. Were big supporters of this idea. This was thought to be a very good thing. And then that same idea, it was Galton called it eugenics, the idea that you could selectively breed the strong. You could give some preference to selectively breeding the strong, and if you did that, you'd get better and stronger and more improved and more thoughtful and more intelligent human beings. Much like you can do this to animals and dogs and cattle, and as had been done in England and other places for years and years and years. And then that idea metastasized to the United States. And it's the United States was, you know, if it was born in England, it was bred and brought up and nursed and coddled in the United States. In the United States, it began to take a kind of more sinister form. And in the United States, the argument was, well, okay, not just should maybe instead of just selectively breeding the strong, what if we selectively sterilize those who are thought to have hereditary traits that are undesirable? And this led to the very famous Carrie Buck case, which has been written about extensively, in which a woman who was sterilized by state mandate, by the Supreme Court's order, because she was thought to carry a gene that was linked to having sort of poor intelligence or imbecility, as it was called back then. And there's a famous Supreme Court opinion which was handed down that, you know, three generations of imbeciles is enough, that the state could, in fact, mandate a sterilization of Carrie Buck, and Carrie Buck was sterilized based on the law. And then the third phase, and this is the last phase, is that this whole idea of eugenics, now already having taken on a sinister form, metastasized back into Nazi Germany, where it was used now not just to sterilize, but to euthanize, but to kill, exterminate people based on their genetic inheritance. And it was in this kindergarten of, first they started with people who had disabilities, people who were blind, had deafness or other kinds of disabilities, and slowly escalated all of this towards, obviously, millions of Jews, gypsies, homosexuals, and dissidents, and so forth. So there's a progression through progressives, sadly, but there's a progression. You can see the whole world stepping into darker and darker waters as we enter this age of eugenics in the 1930s and 1940s, and we've conveniently forgotten most of it. We think that, oh, you know, eugenics was something that happened in Nazi Germany. Far from the case. It was very much very much in our own backyard.
I guess the good thing, if there is one, it's really hard to say this in a way that is not inelegant, but given the association of eugenics with Nazi Germany, the idea fell completely out of favor in the rest of the world.
And eventually, yes, it was the ultimate stamp of shame was brought by the Nazi eugenic scientists.
How did Watson and Crick work out the double helix structure of DNA, and why was that such a revolutionary discovery, knowing how it looked, the form that it took?
It's a story that is kind of the most rollicking scientific story you could tell, because it has all the elements of great science: inspiration, sudden lunges into nowhere,
drama,
and drama, and the finest kind of drama. I'll summarize a little bit just to give you some highlights, but the fuller story is in the book. Watson and Crick decided that this was the big puzzle of the 1940s and 1950s. This is a time when scientists had figured out that it was DNA that was carrying this hereditary information, but they didn't know how. I mean, how on earth could a molecule carry the information that would make your, you know, a nose a particular shape, or give your hair a particular color, or make your temperament a particular manner, or set you up for a disease that might be lethal? So no one knew that, and the suspicion was that somehow that there was a code of some sort. The molecule had to carry a code, and the code was in the molecule, built into the molecule itself. Now, put yourself in those people's shoes. Put yourself in the scientist. Imagine the excitement. There's a code-carrying molecule that's sitting inside your cells, and carrying all this genetic code, but we don't know what it looked like and why it was, what it was shaped like. Was it a, you know, was it a big glob? Was it a long chain? What does it look like? Well, Watson and Crick knew from work that other people had done that it was a long chain, and it had some, it was made up of little units, A, C, T, and G. So they knew that it was made up of these units, but how were these units strung together? Were they in a long chain like A, C, T, G, C, 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 or so forth? Were they twisted around each other? Were they in a big glob, lots of A's together, lots of C's together? No one knew. And they used evidence from crystals that you can. Scientists use crystals to solve structures. But also they used cardboard models. They made cardboard models of these units, A, C, T, and G, and they began to put them in space together, combine them in space. And they also had evidence from really important scientists, other scientists, Rosalind Franklin among them, Morris Wilkins among them. There was a rivalry between Morris Wilkins and Rosalind Franklin, but nonetheless, Watson and Crick were looking at all this information, and suddenly, really in a moment of a fantastic inspiration, they figured out that it was a double helix. That in fact, that there was one helix that carried A, C, T, G, C, C, etc., strung together. And there was another helix that carried the mirror image of the information, just the opposite information, as it were. And these were sort of twined together like two strands, and that was DNA. And the amazing thing about that, it was like a yin and yang structure. And then the amazing thing about all of this is that once that was figured out, once it was known that it was a double helix, all of a sudden you could imagine why it was structured that way. It's a double helix because, you know, when one cell splits to form two cells, basically the yin helix creates its mirror image, the yang, and the yang helix creates its mirror image, the yin, and that's how they separate. They're two. And that's why they're paired to some extent. That's why they're paired, because these two pairs essentially split apart and recreate themselves in their own image and form the next set of helices. And this is how things propagate over and over again. That's one property that was deduced directly from that structure, from the molecular structure. But there are all sorts of properties of heredity that arise from this molecular structure. It was the most beautiful explanation that anyone had given how a molecule could carry a code, and that code could be transmitted across from one generation to another generation. People called it the most beautiful molecule in the history of molecules, if you're an aficionado of that kind of stuff.
Craig Venter and his team famously mapped the complete human genome for the first time at the start of this century. What does it actually mean to map the human genome?
Well, let's just correct that a little bit. It's absolutely true that Craig Venter and his team mapped the human genome, or sequenced the human genome, I should say. But this was a parallel effort by led by the government that also reached the same human genome sequence at the same time. And in fact, it was jointly announced at the White House in 2001, and that was the basis of the end of the Human Genome Project. Now, what does it mean to map the human genome? Well, let's forget about the word map for a second and go back to what we just talked about, that, you know, the human genome is carried in 23 chromosomes, essentially 23 packets. And each packet contains hundreds of thousands, millions of these A, C, T, G, C, 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 T, C, G, 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 and so forth, strung together in a massive chain. And so the sequencing of the human genome is to say that I'm going to learn the human genome has 3 billion such nucleotides, or ACTGs, strung along and divided into these 23 packets. And the sequencing of the human genome is to say I'm going to know the exact sequence of the entire 3 billion of the human genome. Now, that, of course, is the code that makes us who we are. It's the code that makes a chimpanzee a chimpanzee, another code that makes a chicken a chicken. So the idea is that if we could understand all the elements of the code, then we could begin to decode how a human being can arise out of a single cell, for instance.
what this isn't is the equivalent of knowing what each of those genes do. Can you talk about the process by which the functions of particular genes or whatever goes wrong when those genes mutate are identified?
There's a whole variety of ways. I'll highlight some. Well, one way we know that when the functions is by understanding diseases. So we know, for instance, in a disease like cystic fibrosis, that something goes wrong in the genetic code, that all of a sudden the lung doesn't work normally and you start getting infections, as we know from patients with cystic fibrosis. We know also that, let's say you have a family with a heightened risk of breast cancer or Tay-Sachs disease. Again, something must go wrong in the code that allows or that enables a different kind of morphology or form to be created. And so that's a very different kind of project. It's like saying, to give an analogy, it's like saying the human genome, the sequence of the human genome is like a giant encyclopedia. And if you don't know the meanings of the words, the giant encyclopedia will be a meaningless encyclopedia. It'll be a whole string of alphabets, 26 alphabets, strung together one after the other in long stretches. And if you didn't know the language, let's say it was in French or some other language, you would come into that encyclopedia. You wouldn't know what to make head or tail out of it. You would know that there was some kind of code involved, but you wouldn't know what any of that meant. So the efforts to make meaning out of the human genome, to functionalize it, to understand function, is a parallel effort. Of course, they're interrelated. You need to know the sequence to need to find out what's different. But they're interlinked, like two strands of DNA, as it were.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He is assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and staff cancer physician at Columbia University Medical Center. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer. He has a new book out now that he considers a prequel to that book. It's called The Gene, An Intimate History. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes, and we'll be taking your calls at 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us via email to think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee, assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Gene, An Intimate History. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. That's where we find Bruce on the line in Pantego. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was wondering, what's the difference between the current practices of genetic engineering and the newer techniques of gene editing? And what are some of the pros and cons of that? Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. A fascinating area, important question. So just to give a little bit of background, we're talking about gene editing. The question was about gene editing. What is gene editing? Gene editing is refers to a host of new technologies that allow us to use various techniques to essentially change the code in the human genome. Or any genome, actually, but the human genome is obviously the most troubling and most important, and potentially has the most promise. So, again, just to give you a simple analogy, imagine the human genome, as I said before, as an encyclopedia. If it was an encyclopedia, then it would stretch. It would be actually 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, full sets, and it would just read ACT, GC, CCT, sort of in very inscrutably. on and on and on and on for 66 full such sets, 3 billion odd letters. Now, what gene editing allows us to do, and I'm using it a lot in my own laboratory, people are using it across the world, what gene editing allows you to do is to essentially enter the encyclopedia and take one word in that 66 set and change that word or erase that word or change it into something else. Now, it's important to realize that the technology is still in its infancy. You can't change every word. Sometimes you get the wrong word. Sometimes you make a mistake. But in principle, now that's possible to do. So you could say, well, so what are its potential applications? Well, some important applications might be, well, you could go into the lung cells of someone with, let's say, a lung disease like cystic fibrosis and change the genes that are responsible for that disease. So those have enormous promise. But on the other hand, you could also say, well, what if I started making these changes in human embryos? Can I make these similar changes in human embryo cells? What would that be? And we don't know. In fact, we have decided there should be strong barricades against gene editing technologies in human embryos because we don't know their risks. Now, the important thing is that gene editing is one of several different kinds of techniques that allow us to engineer the human genome. It's one example. There's a big superset, which is all techniques that allow us to engineer the human genome, and gene editing is one of them.
What's the CRISPR technique? Is that what you're talking about here?
That's what we're talking about. CRISPR is one of those techniques, and it allows us to do gene editing. CRISPR is a technical name for a series of techniques that allow us to, as I said, go into the 66 encyclopedia set, change one word, and we think leave most of the other words untouched, although we won't know that for at least a few more years until some of the main experiments are sorted out.
One thing that's really an interesting ethical question with regard to gene editing is that you can have a gene or even a mutated gene for something, and there's not an absolute guarantee that it will cause a problem, right? So how do we decide when it's worth trying to make an adjustment if, in fact, we have the technological capability to do so?
This is this question that sits at the center of the ethics debate today, and this is actually where the book sort of inexorably leads. The question is, how do we know when to intervene and what to intervene on? Again, my own family history of mental illness plays a big role in all of this. I wrote this book as a kind of way to find out. I mean, under what circumstance should we intervene genetically? My own standards are basically driven by my experience as a physician and driven by having compassion and skepticism about what we're doing next. I'll give you my own thoughts about this, but of course this is a massive public debate and it should be a public debate. But what I argue for in the book is that one thing, that there are three criteria that have to be at least met for us to be able to think about doing genetic engineering, whether it's through CRISPR or other techniques in the human genome. Number one is that we should establish that what we're doing is to change or mitigate or treat or cure diseases that cause extraordinary suffering, that we shouldn't be using these techniques. There's no reason to be using these techniques for reasons that have nothing to do with extraordinary suffering. So, for instance, like enhancing ourselves, enhancing height, enhancing, a particular color of skin that you might have a preference for. In any case, we now know that these, height and skin and things like that, there's no single gene for them. So extraordinary suffering is one strong sort of line that we probably need to assess and cross. And then the second one is that the genes that we're intervening on should be genes that where there's a very clear one-to-one relationship between having that gene mutation and having the disease. So when we want to do genetic interventions, we're not trying to intervene on genes that may increase your risk for a particular disease by 5% or 10%. Those are unpredictable outcomes. We should probably leave those alone. In any case, under those circumstances, probably there are too many genes to be changed anyway. And the third, probably the most important one, the third edge of the triangle, as I describe it, is that all of this should be done without a state mandate and with perfect freedom of choice. So no woman should be asked to sequence the genome of her child. by any mandate. She should be free to carry forward whatever genome that she would like to carry forward, and that there should be a large public discussion around this idea about, you know, under what circumstances is intervention permissible. But those are at least three standards, or three sides of a triangle, as I describe it in the book, that we should meet.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mike on the line in Garland. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Chris. I just wanted to mention, a few years ago I saw an interesting program on NOVA on the subject of epigenetics. And I would like Dr. Mukherjee kind of to tell us about that and what's the current state of understanding of that process.
Thanks for your call.
It's a huge field, and I'll try to summarize some highlights from it. And certainly it's covered richly in the book, but it's a huge field. Some apologies up front, because it's often hard to summarize these massive fields in simple, you know, short periods of time. But epigenetics really arises from a question, and that it's important to return to the question. And the question is, how is it that one genome, the same genome, can get manifest in such different ways in different forms? That process is called epigenesis. And the question is, just to give you a simple example, how is it that one genome, you know, when you start off from in an embryo, you start off from one cell, and yet when you grow up, when adults are formed, a blood cell arises out of that same genome and looks nothing like a neuron in your brain. And by logic of the same extension, you know, two identical genomes, two identical twins placed in the same environment, or placed in different environments, will look very different from each other. So they're basically asking the same question: how do you take one genome and make, all these various forms or cells or outcomes out of that one genome? And the answer is, well, we talked a little bit about this already before, but the answer is we know that genes contain not just the information to build form, but also information about when and how to build form. And how that process occurs over time. And we know that genes make proteins, and these proteins conduct the genome. It's like saying, you know, they'll play the violin at one part, and then basically, you know, only in the blood cell will the violin be played out of that same master orchestra, and only in the neuron will the cello be played, and so forth. And the process by which this unfolds is a cascade. It starts off with these conductors, these master regulators, these master factors that conduct the genome. And then that process gets sequentially transmitted down so that the genome can be used in different ways in different cells. That process, the fact that, you know, that these that the genome is ultimately used different ways in different cells, explains epigenesis. And epigenetics is a term that scientists have invented to try to describe ways in which the genome is marked or changed such that this process can act out and make different genes, as different cells and forms out of the different genes. Long explanation, there's still an internal debate about, you know, what should qualify as epigenetic and what should not qualify as epigenetic. But the take-home message is that epigenetics tries to answer the question, how does the same genome become manifest in such different forms over time and space?
Just to be provocative here, why is it wrong to consider using gene science to enhance a future generation?
So for several reasons. Number one is the obvious answer would be unintended consequences.
Yeah.
We don't know what the consequences are of changing the human genome in particular. We might change one gene hoping to achieve one outcome and may influence another outcome in the wrong way. But I think, and I point this out in the book, the deeper question is that it's not just unintended biological consequences, but unintended human and cultural and social consequences, which is to say, all of a sudden, if we think of ourselves as malleable in this way, if we're going to use technologies to change ourselves, where do we stop? What are the criteria that allow us to make these changes? Let's say we begin to do this. Does that change the way we think of ourselves in terms of our vulnerability? Does it change compassion for ourselves in the future? Um, so not only are there unintended consequences that are biological, there are unintended consequences that are social and cultural. It changes the way we think about ourselves as human beings. And we have to be cognizant of that and take it very seriously, because what we're changing is not just ourselves, but ourselves for every generation to come, potentially. And that when we've done this in the past, when we've tried to do this in the past, we haven't, as we spoke about early in the hour, we haven't done it particularly carefully. So it behooves us to go and think about it more deeply before we make these changes.
What for you are the most vexing unanswered questions as of 2016 about the way that genes work and what we might do with them?
Some of them include, for the human genome, we don't know exactly what the human genome encodes. We think there are 21,000 genes, but we don't know how those 21,000 genes, 22,000, the number's always changing, play themselves out in time and space to make you and me. What are the functions of these 21,000 elements? Why is it that you know, these enormous stretches of DNA right now don't have any ascribed function? These are questions that we're going to try to solve, to functionalize the human genome, to understand how that code becomes, that master code becomes you and me, how it establishes variations between you and me, and at the same time maintains the amazing similarity between you and me. You know, if someone zoomed in from outer space, they would say, well, the two of you look similar, but you're also different. How does a 3-billion-letter code do both of those at the same time? These are questions I think are the most vexing and most interesting in the human genome. There are dozens of other questions, but I'm fascinated by these in particular.
Is there more variation between individual human beings than there is individual elephants or chimpanzees or sperm whales?
It depends on the species, and again, depends on the age of the species. You can imagine, the simple answer is, the older the species is, the more differences there will be between individuals, because there will be more and more variation accumulating over time. They'll diverge more and more over time. Human beings are very young, so in fact, we have very little divergence. Chimpanzees are older, so they have more divergence across, you know, the whole chimpanzee universe, as it were. There's more divergence.
Okay, I'm going to end on an unrelated question because I really have to know this. I genuinely wonder how you do so much. You're a researcher. You deal with patients. You're a professor. You're an author. You have a wife and two kids. Do you have a 28-hour day, or how do you work all of this into your professional and personal life?
This book was a labor of love. It took a long time. It took 5 years. And I combined taking sabbaticals. I still saw patients, although I saw patients one day a week. And I continued to do the research, although I cut back from writing certain kinds of grants. And it was, you know, I worked every day on it. I worked hours and hours and hours and tried to do the best I could with what has ended up being a 600-page book.
Do you have a favorite relaxation technique?
I like to read for pleasure, and the more I read, the more I learn. So it ends up being relaxing, but on the other hand, I learn how to write and learn more information at the same time. There's nothing I like to do more than reading.
Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee is Assistant Professor of Medicine at Columbia University and Staff Cancer Physician at Columbia University Medical Center. His new book is called The Gene, An Intimate History. Siddhartha, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you. I'm a big fan of your show. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer, with help on the phones today from Alex Smith. And Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.